indigenous people would say, we don't manage resources. We try to establish good relations with relatives. Think of how different it is to think about walking outside your door and stepping into a world full of relatives as opposed to a world full of resources. Now, when you live among resources, it always gets down to this issue of rights. Whose right is it? When you live among relatives, you have responsibilities.
Welcome to Wild's podcast, Voices of Wilderness. Through the stories our guests share, you'll learn about how we can and must protect wilderness for a healthy future. We hope to leave you a little bit more inspired to speak out, take action, make a difference, and find solutions to the biodiversity and climate crises. Let us take you on a journey through the different aspects of wilderness, its different stories, approaches, and definitions in different parts of the world with the people who work every day to fight for its protection. Welcome to this very special episode, where we're thrilled to be joined by Dan Wildcat, a Yuchi member of the Muscogee Nation of Oklahoma. He is passionately dedicated to bridging the gap between climate change and Indigenous people. His latest work, On Indigenuity, Learning the Lessons of Mother Earth, explores how Indigenous wisdom can guide us in tackling today's challenges. Together, and in this conversation, we unpacked this concept of indigenuity, exploring indigenous eco-kinship, questioning the Western divide between spirituality and science, and rediscovering our connection to Earth. Get ready for an enlightening journey as we navigate these crucial topics with Dan. Let's dive in. All righty, so we are joined today by Dan Wildcat. We are so excited for this conversation. It has been many weeks, many months in the planning and the preparation, and we cannot wait to pick your brain today about all the incredible things that you work on and that you work for. Can you please tell the Voices of Wilderness audience a little bit about yourself and what you work to protect and what you work on?
Yeah, Sanlay, Gelasan, Songele, Zoyaha, Uchiha, Muscogee, Shadane, Adene. Good morning, Jackie. Yes, my name is Dan Wildcat. I am a Yuchi, a Zoyaha member of the Creek Nation of Oklahoma. My name is Wildcat, and just delighted to have this invitation to visit with you. So, what I am working for right now is really the health of our planet, Mother Earth. I think anyone who's paying attention knows that so far the age of the Anthropocene, the age of humans, has not been very good for the balance of non-human life on the planet. And so I'm really, my work is all around that intersection between global climate change and indigenous peoples. I'm fortunate right now, I've been working in that area for about 15, 16 years now, did a book about, oh my gosh, it's been, 14 years now, called Red Alert, Saving the Planet, you know, with indigenous knowledge. And now I've just come out with a new book, a collection of, really it's an extended essay, a collection of essays we kind of put together, wove together. My publisher at Fulcrum helped me do that. And the title of that book is called On Indigenuity. I'm all about applying indigenous ingenuity, which I call indigenuity, to solve the problems that we are facing today. So I'm working for Mother Earth. I'm doing so through a large NSF grant that we received at my institution, Haskell Indian Nations University, where we are working with four coastal communities. Everyone has seen the pictures of what's happening in the barrier island off the coast of Alaska, Shishmaref. That is one of our research sites. We're working in Hawaii. We are working on the Louisiana Gulf Coast and working in Puerto Rico. So it's a huge project, the biggest project I've ever tried to direct in my life. But it's really about those indigenous peoples, those often marginalized, you know, underserved peoples who are really on the front lines of facing the existential threat of climate change on those coastlines that are their homelands. And so that's the kind of work I'm engaged in. It's incredibly rewarding. Sometimes it seems, you know, impossible, but I've got a great team. I mean, I've got like, you know, major scientific organizations that are partners in the project. About, I think last count, we had 97 individuals that are working on this. So the project is called the Rising Voices Changing Coast Convergence Science Hub. The convergence science, people say, well, what's convergence science? You can think of it as kind of interdisciplinary science, but what we have proposed for our work is we are bringing indigenous wisdom and knowledges together with some of the best physical climate scientists in the world to create a better understanding of what is going on these coastlines where people live, have called their homeland for hundreds, thousands of years.
Right. And so I'm so excited for this conversation because this space of indigenous knowledge has been something that at WILD, we firmly believe needs to come to the forefront of conservation and needs to be an integral part of how we problem solve as we move forward with these huge issues that are going on with our planet and the environment. And so I cannot wait to dive into some of this knowledge that you just have all in your brain and that you've been working on. So we like to start out by asking every one of our guests this question, just kind of to get a baseline. What does wilderness mean to you? And what feelings does that invoke?
Yeah. So wilderness is an interesting idea, the idea of the wild. The first point I would make, indigenous people never had a word for the wild. They lived in places with the life, the plants, the animals, the earth, the water, the wind, the air, and that was their home. They saw themselves as a part of it. So I think wilderness is really largely, as we use it today in the United States and increasingly around the world, is sort of a very non-indigenous idea, because indigenous people, by virtue of this incredible relationship they had, living with nature, living as a part of a natural ecosystem, never thought of the balance of that life around them as wild. They tend to think of that almost in kinship terms. I'm so glad to carry the surname Wildcat, Boshi or Shadane in my language, and that was a clan totem. And so we identified ourselves as human beings with these non-human relatives we have. And I think that's the real challenge today. I so much appreciate the work that people do, like WILD and the wilderness organizations, to kind of preserve what we have left. But and we know that's increasingly threatened. I just met with some people from the upper Amazon about 4 weeks ago, and to look at the really, I hate to say it, but the life and death struggles they are having sometimes to save their homelands in the upper Amazon from, you know, extractive economic, you know, exploitation. And so my short answer would be, never really thought about the wilderness or the wild, But I think in terms of the challenge we have today is how we reconnect our human selves with this larger kinship network. We are a part of ecosystems, the plants, the animals, the earth, the water. That's part of the wisdom I think indigenous people have to share, that, hey, we are surrounded with this natural world. Most of it's been very heavily impacted and mediated by human activity, but the earth is still there. The life is still there. We need to figure out how to honor that, how to become more attentive to that.
You know, and you say we're surrounded by this wilderness, but really, in my opinion, too, we're a part of it. And we love to think.
Yes, absolutely.
We love to think that as humans, we're outside of it. Or
exactly.
There is this whole idea of, to me, the idea of wilderness. There's a dichotomy there of things that are not wild and things that you can control. Wilderness, you can't control. But what if, at least to me, I get on this spiral of ideas. Okay, what if you just surrender that idea of control and rather than trying to control these elements, work with them. Work with them and find a way forward to work harmoniously with them. I mean, it's a huge, we could talk about that for a very long time too, but yes, I...
Well, but I think it's an important point. And think about, so we have this, you know, my history has been shaped since settlers arrived here in North America, you know, from other places by this dichotomy between the civilized and the wild. We all, that kind of binary dichotomous thinking is well grounded in the narratives of our history and the like. And then there's another dichotomy, which you just mentioned, which is so critical to understand because this is the source of, I think, of indigenous wisdom and knowledge. And that is this nature culture dichotomy. Oh, is it nature or is it culture? That doesn't make any sense for indigenous people because our cultures, the way we lived, how we lived, the food we ate, the tools we used, the clothing we wore, the dwellings we constructed, those were emergent out of these relationships with the land, with the plants, with the animals. In other words, what I always stress is, one way to understand indigenous cultures is to understand that their cultures were shaped in this symbiotic relationship between a place and a people. We've lost that in modern industrial and some people might say post-industrial societies. People think they can work anywhere. They can live anywhere, you know. But in an earlier time, the way we work, the way we live, was shaped by the place that we called home. I think the work that we are all trying to do really is calling on us to restore a mindfulness about that relationship.
Right. And so at this point in time in history, in this pivotal point where we're really facing a lot that could go wrong and very, very wrong.
Yes, exactly.
What is this indigenous worldview, this eco-kinship, this indigenuity, why is it so pivotal? I have my opinions because I'm a firm believer that it is very pivotal, obviously. But from your perspective and from your expertise and your knowledge and your immersion in it, and just, you know, this is who you are, why is it so pivotal right now?
It's pivotal right now because we are not going to be able to face the physical climate changes we are confronting on our Mother Earth today unless we undergo and facilitate a cultural climate change. Everyone's heard this apocryphal kind of quote attributed to Einstein, although there's no evidence Einstein ever said it. But you've heard it. It goes something like this. You can't fix problems with the same kind of thinking that created them. We have inherited in the modern world this view where man is at the pinnacle of, you know, the food chain, of intelligence, of knowledge. And in some versions of Christian religious traditions, we're sort of placed in charge of all of this. And I think that what's most valuable and why we need to listen to Indigenous people today, I think what they bring to our awareness and this mindfulness I'm arguing for is the fact that we're just one person's kind of persons among many persons on this planet, plant persons, animal persons. And I think the notion that it's all about us, the age of humans, that this is the challenge we have today, is to recognize that that is part of our problem, that if we kind of construct and see ourselves as in charge and then denominate the balance of creation as resources that we're going to use and that we are going to manage, note the difference. That's a dominant way of thinking today about natural resource management, forest management, oceans management. Indigenous people would say, we don't manage resources. We try to establish good relations with relatives. Think of how different it is to think about walking outside your door and stepping into a world full of relatives as opposed to a world full of resources. Now, that leads us to another point that's really critical. When we live in a world of resources, everyone gets tied up in these arguments about who has the right to use that resource. Whose resource is that? We are so fixated, particularly in the United States, about rights. I mean, we just went through a major pandemic, and I had people in my community tell me they would not wear a mask because I was violating their inalienable rights. And I asked those people occasionally, I would say, well, do you have any inalienable responsibilities? When you live among resources, it always gets down to this issue of rights. Whose right is it? When you live among relatives, you have responsibilities. And so I think this kind of two-stage movement, you know, from a world full of resources to one full of relatives, that's a very ancient indigenous way of thinking about things, to counterbalancing inalienable rights. We recognize rights as much as anyone, but we recognize those rights are literally and figuratively groundless if they are not counterbalanced with inalienable responsibilities. We have responsibilities, and basically we've been behaving very, humankind has been behaving very bad for several centuries now because we have not been treating our other relatives on this planet very well. That is a great place to begin an exploration of indigenous knowledge and wisdom.
And I think it's so spot on that this, you know, you started with the Einstein quote, or who knows if it won't, but the quote, and it's this idea of we have been relying on the exact same framework to fix the problems that have come up, and it's not working.
Yeah.
It's not working. And, you know, I think we get so stuck, especially in the environmental world, and I've spoken about this a few times. I'm very passionate about it. I love it. I love this space. I love being able to talk to interesting people and to try and problem solve together.
Yeah.
But so much of this space has relied on the same sort of thinking and the same reliance on hard, I'm saying hard facts of science, of instinct that are really measurable. And that's not solving the problem. If it had solved the problem, if it were to solve the problem, it would have already solved the problem. And it's we're not there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this shifting of mindset is really interesting to me because I think it's going to be so incredibly critical in the next few years. And you touched on that too. But I ask myself, and I ask you too, because it's something I think about all the time, how should people approach this changing mentality? And especially I'm speaking more so for white Western culture that is so ingrained in thinking that science is the answer, that structure, that this removal from being part of nature. How do we move forward in that shift and that change there's no concrete, you know, definite response to this. It's really just, I'm so intrigued by what you think on that.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. And, you know, here's what is happening now. And some of this audience will know this, some might not. So right about the time I published Red Alert, that came out in 2009, my Red Alert book came out. And right about that same time, I started getting invitations from NASA, from NOAA, from major scientific organizations to give presentations. Something was happening. People there were wanting to hear what indigenous people had to say. I think that's hopeful. I think what is going on right now, Jackie, is I think there are a lot of people, particularly in your generation, who, let's face it, you look around and you go like, you know, for all of our great technological accomplishments and everything, things aren't going so well right now, you know, or the biodiversity on the planet, you know, for increasing rates of species extinction, life extinction on the planet, water quality, air quality, you know, the list goes on and on. And I think particularly younger people are very open to looking at other ways of understanding their lives and the relationship they have to the balance of creation. So that's hopeful. It's also happening in science. I think one of the things about global climate change is we can't put that in a controlled experimental setting to figure out, hey, how do we solve this problem? It's a global problem. So it demands that we have global thinking, that we have a lot of different ways of looking at things. So I think this is hopeful. So what I would say to everyone is pay attention to what is going on now with major scientific organizations. I mean, NSF has given us $20 million to create this. The name of our project is the Change, a Rising Voices, Changing Coast Convergent Science Hub. So we're a hub here at Little Haskell Indian Nations University in the heartland of the U.S., but we're the center for all of this work that is going on these coastlines, Puerto Rico, you know, Louisiana, Alaska, Hawaii. And so I think what's going on is that we're in a moment where I think people who are mindful and paying attention are recognizing we've got to do something different. And maybe part of that is related to we've got to put on a new lens. That old resource rights lens needs to be replaced. So let's get a new lens. And turns out the new lens is an ancient lens. It's the lens of the first peoples of this land. And I think they should be humble. They should be mindful that, you know, not every tribal person they meet to is going to be immediately welcoming them with open arms because of the history we've had. But I think over time, there is going to be an opportunity to start these kinds of discussions that are going to advance this understanding. And I'm going to give you one very contemporary example I know you'll be aware of. When Standing Rock, at the end of that two-year direct action campaign of those led by women, by the way, let's not forget the role women, indigenous women, have played in this whole movement. So Standing Rock was led really by women, the mothers, the grandmothers, the aunties of Standing Rock. So they occupied up there by Sacred Stone Camp along the Missouri River, you know, to try to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline from going under the Missouri River. They occupied those camps for what, almost 2 years. Remember at the very end when the government said, we're going to clean you out, you're going to have to move out. What happened? Hundreds, several thousand people came to Standing Rock. And in those final days, there were more non-indigenous allies standing shoulder to shoulder with the indigenous people than there were indigenous people. When I saw that, I said, something's happening because we have many potential allies out there who are willing to stand with us. And so we've got to have a long discussion about what that means. Allyship is not easy because we've got a history we've got to talk about and work through, but that's hopeful. And so I want to encourage all of those people who, you know, have long since lost their indigenous heritage. By the way, I've got to share just a brief story. Some of you will recognize the name Thomas Binyakiwa. He was a messenger for the traditional knowledge holders of the Hopi peoples. And Thomas went all around talking about something called the Hopi prophecy. I'm not going to go into that now. But the Hopi had visions and had received information about what we were going to be experiencing. Thomas Binyakiwa was kind of their messenger. And I remember he came up to this woman who was working in her college, and she looked a lot like you, Jackie. And he walked up to her and he says, "So, what tribe are you a member of?" And she goes, Oh, no, I'm not a member of a tribe. I'm not a member of a tribe." And he looked right at her and he says, "Yes, you are." He says, "You've just forgotten that tribal heritage. We, every human on this planet, lived as members of tribes for much longer than we've been citizens of modern nation states." Think about that. I was so glad he made that point. I mean, again, that's something that we have within our collective consciousness, if you will, to start exploring and drawing on. But so I think we have opportunities. I would just caution people to be humble, to be respectful, and the most important communication skill you should have if you want to try to understand is listening. Listening. Just listen.
It's so true. I have like 1,000 thoughts. And Julia's smiling because she knows that I so resonate with everything that you are saying because it is so true. We cling on to this idea that, I mean, the story, I'm so glad that you told the story about which tribe are you from. We Western, specifically white people, love to think that they're not part of this, everything else that's gone on in the rest of history, well, humankind. And like you said, we've just forgotten. And there is a layer of complexity there, right? Because there's a lot of history. There's a lot of sad history and hurtful history too.
Oh, absolutely. We all have that. And yeah.
There's a time before that. There's a time when everybody was part of a tribe, when everybody was part of this connectivity to the natural world, and not just the natural world, but just more of, I don't want to say necessarily just spirituality, but this whole connectivity of the universe sort of thing. And I'm really out there, but
yeah,
we've lost that. We forgot about that, and we need to reconnect to that. And I think the point that you're making with bringing this indigenous knowledge to the forefront of conservation, but also this reigniting in human soul of this connectivity is so critical and crucial and truthfully really beautiful because we're a world very divided.
Absolutely. And I think that's so critical, you know, to keep in mind and to understand. I think that in a lot of ways, you know, what we are trying to do is to remind people that, you know, again, and this is kind of, we're so trapped in these binaries, and that it obscures these more complex relational, interconnected kind of relationships that we are a part of. And I think this whole religion versus science is another example of a very miseducative, unuseful dichotomy. Because in indigenous traditions, the spirit with which we draw on is a part of the life that we try to understand. That physical life, that kind of hard to sit, you know, dividing line between the spiritual and the physical, largely non-existent for many indigenous people on the planet.
I think what you're saying is just absolutely fascinating. I could speak with you for many hours on this and honestly listen to you for multiple hours because the amount of knowledge that you have is incredible. And so I don't want to finish this interview because I love the way that it's going and I love hearing what you say. We usually typically try and end on why do people have hope, but truthfully throughout this entire conversation that we've had, it's very clear that you do have hope and that there is a hopeful aspect to this. If there's a small victory that you've already seen happen, Standing Rock was such a beautiful example of that with the allyship that is possible. If there's anything else that you'd like to add, any nuggets of advice or wisdom that you'd like to share, we are all ears and I'd love to talk to you again because as we continue in our work at Wild, especially leading up to the 12th World Wilderness Congress in late August, there's so much work that we have to do, but also, you know, the focus of it is Indigenous knowledge and bringing that to the forefront. So I'd love to have you on again and chat with you. But if there's anything else that you'd like to add, we are all ears, please.
Well, I'm going to share a couple of things that I've been thinking a lot about recently. And this work that I do, it's not my work. It's a part of all of these rich relatives that I work with. In fact, you know, in our hub, I refer to everyone, all the scientists, all the community members, those people that we're working with on the ground, I refer to them as kin. I say, you know, we're all kin in this project. We are all related. We are part of this kind of expansive eco-kinship kind of family. And I say that because I'm promoting people to start thinking very differently about the work we do. And I want to make just a couple of quick observations. The first one is we have a marvelous elder we work with, retired emeritus professor from University of Hawaii, American Samoan elder. We just call him Doc Tusi. Fela Tusi of Viglio is his given name. We just call him Doc Tusi or Papa Lee Tusi. We honor him, you know, as an elder. And he said something in a meeting. I was at the Pacific Risk Management Ohana meeting we were in Honolulu. This was last March. And we were talking, and someone said in the middle of a big conversation we were having, as a session we were doing, says, okay, but, you know, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to fix this situation? And Doc Tusi raised his hand and said, we need to be very careful about the language we use. He says, this is not about fixing it. This is about healing our relationships. And there you go. There's that incredible, it's just like, bam, you know, hey, this isn't just a physical problem. This is a feeling, an emotional, this is about who we are. And I thought that was so powerful. And everyone just goes immediately, yeah, this isn't about fixing a machine. It's about healing this incredible life system that we are a part of, that we've done such harm to, not intentionally necessarily, but because we haven't thought about those relationships in the right way. I thought that was incredibly powerful. The other thing that I want to acknowledge too, and as you can tell, I am passionate about this work, but in my work, I'm always calling on people to accept that deep relationality, that kinship with plants, with animals, with the earth, with the water, with the wind. And I realize right now how difficult that is Because think of how poorly we're treating each other, even among our own species. And I want to acknowledge that. I want to say that we have, it'd be nice if we had one crisis at a time to deal with. We've got multiple crises in the world today. And I want to tell people I understand that. I am, the kinds of struggles, the pains, the difficulties that people are facing sometimes in their everyday lives. They're not really thinking about global climate change as a number one issue when you're not sure if you're going to have water to drink or food for your family, health care, housing. We've got a lot of issues that we need to face. And I want to honor that, acknowledge that, and say, yes, I understand. I think part of what we can do is we've got to show that some of these things are very interrelated. The food shortage issue we have, that's more about the systems, the human systems that we operate in, rather than can we figure out a way to feed people on the planet? I think we could if we had different systems in place, right? And so with all of that upon us, I want to share something I've been trying to put in words for a couple of years, and it kind of goes like this. Beauty surrounds us. Much ugliness too. This our wise ones tell us. Both are real, but only one is true. And the question is, what will shape you? The ugliness around us or the beauty surrounding us? I think we have to be able to acknowledge the ugliness we see in this world, but we can never lose the ability to see the beauty around us. And I give thanks for that every day of my life.
I don't even know what to say. I feel like I have tears in my eyes because it's so true. I'm not even sure what to say. Julia, I have no words because that is absolutely beautifully said and so incredibly true.
Well, I just want to say, Sanle Oyasate. Thank you so much, Jackie, Julia, for giving me this opportunity to be with you today. And we'll plan something in the future, okay? We'll make sure this isn't a one-off.
Absolutely. This will not be a one-off. Thank you so much for your time, for your wisdom, for sharing, for letting us listen. We're honored. It's been such a pleasure, and we cannot wait to reconnect. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Find us on social media through the Wild Foundation or through our website, wild.org. And hey, if you're feeling inspired, don't hesitate to share this podcast with those around you, and maybe even rate us on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts. We appreciate the support more than you know, and it's that support that allows our work to continue and evolve.